Okay, I think, is this working? You can hear all that. We're ready to go. My name is Bill Garvelink, and on behalf of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, I'd like to welcome you all here today. And today's discussion is part of the Chevron Forum on Development. Today, the private sector is increasingly active in emerging markets and fragile states, but we see quite often that insecurity at a national level or regional level undermines the private sector's willingness to engage in these areas. And the instability also negatively affects activities that the private sector already has underway. And the development community faces these same sorts of problems where insecurity undercuts social and economic development. The public sector and civil society organizations, however, not only can promote economic development and social progress, but they can also use their strengths to promote security and to reduce private sector risk. Along with these organizations, the private sector can identify social fractures and other sources of instability. And together, these organizations can craft programs that promote stability and an environment conducive to economic growth. So today, we're going to explore the role of the private sector in promoting sustainable security through economic growth, and how the public sector and civil society can link their strengths and their strategies with the private sector to achieve these ends. And today we have a panel that's certainly well-equipped to answer these kinds of questions. We span a broad range of organizations, and I think you have everyone's bio in the handout that was available outside. So I'm not going to go into any kind of detail and just do the briefest of introductions. To my left is John Argolia, who is the Vice President of Government Services for IDS International and oversees all of their operations and programs. Deji Hastrup is next, and he is the General Manager for Policy, Government, and Public Affairs for Chevron Nigeria. And Krista Henry is the Executive Director of the Fund for Peace. And last but not least is Rob Jenkins, who is the Director of the Office of Transition Initiatives, which is part of the U.S. Agency for International Development. So to each of you, welcome. I'm glad you could be here. I thought I would begin the questioning with Deji, and it's always best to start with some concrete, something concrete rather than hypothetical. So in how do companies deal with the problems presented by insecure environments? And could you give us a picture of what operations are like for Chevron on the ground in Nigeria?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to start by saying thank you for having me on the panel. Chevron has been in Nigeria now for a little over 50 years. And that's a long enough time to learn a few things. We know that security is the primary responsibility of government. There's no question in our minds about that. We also know that sustainable development is not possible without a stable and secure environment. That too has been proved to us by our experience in Nigeria. Nigeria is what some people like to call a perfect storm. It's a country about three quarters the size of the state of Texas, and a population of about half the United States. That's a lot of people in that small space. And there are about over 200 ethnic groups. The economy relies almost entirely on oil. And oil is located, 90% of the oil in Nigeria is located in the Niger Delta area. The Niger Delta area has a geographic terrain that is, to say the least, daunting. creeks, mangroves, swamps, a fairly difficult terrain, but it also has a mixture of ethnic groups. And there's a lot of tension that arises out of that mix. There's a high degree of unemployment, widespread poverty, lack of infrastructure, lots of ethnic tensions over territories. All these things is a fine mixture and a recipe for conflict. And so what we have learned is that the first thing, we've got to do our best not to ignite or contribute to the potential for conflict, to understand and prevent conflict means you have to understand the underlying disposition for conflict, and also we understand that without security, business will not thrive and communities will not fulfill their potential. So we take very active steps to be part of the solution and not one of the problems. We've developed quite a number of what people call innovative models for sustainable development, community engagement, conflict mitigation. We're happy to be in that space. We're happy to be pioneers of some of these new ideas, but we're learning as we go along. It's not a roll in the hay.
That's an understatement. Thank you. Well, if I can switch to Krista, the Fund for Peace has been very much involved, and you have personally in linking the private sector with civil society organizations to promote dealing with the instability and reaching an agreement in civil society that is in fact helpful to the private sector in the areas where they're working. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And it's, like you said, it's not a roll in the hay. we are, the last 10 years, I think we've seen a lot more collaboration between the private sector, NGOs, and governments. I think we recognize that the challenges that Deji pointed out are not going to be addressed if it's not all the sectors working together. The private sector was left alone often in areas and had to take over the role of government or the role of NGOs. And that's not appropriate, that's not good, that's not sustainable. And so I think we've learned as a community over the last 10 years that we've got to find a way to work together if we actually really want to address the problems in the long term. But you know how we do it, it's incredibly difficult, even just at the higher international levels. You know, we are brought together kind of kicking and screaming. We speak different languages, we have different time frames, different expectations, different perspectives, different experiences. And so it's not easy. But I would say if it was easy, it wouldn't be important. And it is so incredibly important for us to learn how to work together. Also, 10 years ago, when my organization started to work a lot with the private sector, other NGOs kind of looked at us very doubtfully. What are they doing? Why are they doing that? They must be doing something wrong. Oh, they just want their money. Oh, they're being bought by Chevron or whoever it is. Nowadays, people get it a lot better. I mean, I think there's still a lot of learning to be done. We have to learn how to actually work together, how to put these things together in a way that has legitimacy with communities. It's always a challenge how to figure out how to work with government. And we say government as if it's one entity. There's, of course, different agencies of government. There's also home government, and then you've got the host government. And at the host government, you know, you've got federal levels that you're working with and local. NGOs, you know, we have NGOs like mine that I call implementation. So we actually go on the ground and try to do things, as well as the research that we do. But we've also got watchdogs, and we need those as well. They're very, very important. So even when you say NGOs, they're not the same. We work with the extractive industry in particular because, well, the truth be told, they're stuck. All the other companies basically say, oh my gosh, if it gets that bad, if it's that bad of a conflict, we're just going to go away because they're not as physically tied to the location as the extractive industry are. And so we recognized that. We also recognized years ago the opportunity that they brought because they were putting in such a large investment and they were going to be staying there. But we also recognize that, unlike other people believe, they don't have as much voice with the government. If they put up too much of a fight, they will get kicked out of the country. They're working in sovereign governments. And so it was really important for us to kind of come together and help and try to be a partner in creating some of the solutions.
Just I want to follow up with one comment you made that compared to some years ago, people are starting to get it and work together now. What brought about the change, do you think?
I think really it's some of the initiatives that we have done. The Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights is one initiative, but what happened is dialogue. We just started talking to each other. We were facing some challenges, and some good individuals thought, I've met so-and-so and had a good conversation. And so eventually you had interpersonal relationships between individuals. And those became more dialogue, and that became then some frameworks that we then started to work on together. And it took us a long time to go from these high-level frameworks to really understanding each other, to figuring out how to work together, to making a difference on the ground. But it started very much with finding out, hey, he actually wants a stable society for him to work in. And hey, he actually wants things to get better. And the military actually would like to leave. Chevron would like to stay. Military would like to leave. But other than that, they want the same thing. So.
Speaking of the military, we met each other about 20 years ago, or 25, at the Peacekeeping Institute.
It's been a while.
So it's a small world, actually, where you run into each other. But you've spent a lot of time in unstable environments, including more than 2 years in Afghanistan recently. I wonder if you could talk about, from your experience, what you see as the root causes of instability, and then some thoughts you might have on how to deal with that, mitigate it, change perceptions, that sort of thing.
I was going to say, sometimes I feel like Washington, D.C. is the most unstable environment I'm in, so based on trying to talk among different players within our own government. But the challenges, as Krista and Denji have talked about, of being able to reach out to different organizations and understand what's happening. I mean, we, as a former military officer, been asked to go into some real places that we've walked in, and it's shameful. We've walked in almost ignorant of the environment. We've walked in not aware of what the history has been, not aware of what the relationships have been, not aware of who the key players are. While that information resides in our government was unable to get that information across boundaries so people had an awareness of what was going on. While that information sat in industry, we didn't know how to reach out to the industry and get it. While that information sat with NGOs and other organizations, again, not aware of how to even talk to these organizations to suck that information in and say, okay, let's before we go in, let's understand what we're walking into. And often, without that understanding, we as a military walk on in doing what we think we're supposed to be doing and causing a worse situation. Not going in thinking we're going in for one mission when, in fact, we're going in for another mission. Perfect example, Somalia. Walking into Somalia thinking we're dealing with the humanitarian crisis and we walk right smack into a civil war. Now, it wasn't just the military who thought that. The whole U.S. government thought that. But when you're the guys on the ground walking into that mess and you think you're giving out food aid, next thing you're fighting other folks who have a different agenda, and you're getting pulled into that agenda, and you don't even realize you've just been played by them, and now you've just caused greater instability. So the challenges of understanding what are the root causes. Why are these people resorting to violence? What's driving them to resort to violence? Because, it takes an awful lot to get somebody to the point to pick up a weapon and kill somebody else. Let's not kid ourselves. That's not something that people do naturally. So what's driving them to do that? And if you don't understand that, you're going to walk into the middle of that situation and just exacerbate it. And again, I've been part of missions that have done that, and it's not been fun. So the key piece is going in and knowing how to engage with the myriad of players and actors who are in that environment. But to get there, it's going to take something before you ever get there, which is it's going to require you to understand those organizations, understand their agendas, understand their mission, their roles, their functions, their capabilities, understand their outlook. And based on that, you then have to make an assessment of how you're going to go in there and not cause more damage, but actually get at working with the population and either supporting those organizations or supporting the indigenous population or both, and how you can work get the different groups to work together. There's a ton of stereotypes out there about the different organizations. And it's really taken our military to start stepping on out in the last 10 years and reaching across both U.S. government boundaries as well as across the NGOs and saying, hey, look, like any stereotype, most are wrong. Okay, and the way you defeat a stereotype is by, one, first getting to understand about that other organization. Two, as Christopher alluded to, getting to then meet the people in those organizations. And it's amazing when you meet those people in those organizations, wow, you start to go, I have a respect for what they do. When you show a little bit of respect for what they do, then you're able to generate trust. When you're able to generate trust, you're able to work together. So while I said one of the more unstable environments in Washington, D.C., I don't see that happening to the degree it should be back here. When you get up to out in the field, it's amazing to watch how folks with so many different stereotypes are able to work through those stereotypes and start to form a group that can start working to support one another and at least have a respect for what the different groups are trying to do. And I think that's a critical piece. We just got to learn how to do that back here, and I don't think we've broken that code yet.
Right. And Rob, just to talk a little bit about the Office of Transition Initiatives. I'm not sure if people know exactly what OTI does, but it works in large part in conflict situations and unstable environments. And could you talk about how OTI goes about laying the foundation for a secure environment for development and economic growth? Most often you guys, and maybe the disaster people, are the first ones into an environment like this, certainly on the civilian side. And if you don't set the stage properly, that ripples through the rest of the involvement of the development agencies and that sort of thing. So your role is a critical one.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, and it's also not a roll in the hay. It gets a little bit difficult. We used to say that OTI worked in post-conflict countries. And increasingly, especially since 9/11, many of us find ourselves working where it's no longer post-conflict. It's a phrase that doesn't even mean much anymore. It's conflict, which makes it difficult. OTI, the Office of Transition Initiatives, our official mission statement is to advance peaceful democratic change in priority countries in conflict and crisis. I like to say it's to make a critical difference in the world's most critical places at the most critical times. We all recognize that these transitional countries take a long time to get put onto the right path. The World Bank, and I don't usually or very often draw people to the World Bank study of this or that, but last year, the 2011 World Development Report, really, if you haven't seen it, I would urge all of you to take a look at it. They looked back probably to, you know, World War II and since, all the different countries that have come out of these crises and found that it actually is to fix them, for a country to get to the point where it's no longer developing, takes a generation or two. The average is between 20 to 40 years. Right? They said basically, if you look at all the different countries that have done it, the same problems have been fixed. And the problems boil down to security, boil down to jobs, and justice. Easier said than done. And then we're supposed to jump in OTI, and Congress likes us to be in countries for only 2 to 3 years. So we know we are not going to see that transition through, but our job is to jump in, try to, as John alluded to, as fast as you can, get a laydown of what actually is driving this crisis, what actually is keeping this transition potentially from being on a positive trajectory, trying to understand as many of the players and or dynamics as we can, and then try to make some very discrete, very targeted, catalytic projects, activities, efforts, initiatives, call them what you will, but do what we can with limited money, working with the rest of the U.S. government, other international donors, and always, most importantly, the people in that country, both the civil society and that country, host government, to try to do what we can in that short time frame to keep that country's transition on a positive trajectory. And it means many different things in different places. I like to say if you've seen one OTI program, you've seen one OTI program. That's somewhat true, but if you look at almost all of them, and these are places as diverse as northern Uganda or Colombia to Afghanistan to Sudan, places like Tunisia and Libya and Cote d'Ivoire, recently going back in our history to Indonesia, to the Balkans before that. Lots of different situations, but in almost all of them, we do one thing, which is to work with civil society actors, find agents of change, because they are going to have the best ideas always, find people with great ideas on how they want to help fix their country, and fund that, and work with them, and open up avenues for their voices to be heard and for them to be part of the process. And also on the other side, it's getting government to open up to those voices in those processes. Sometimes it's more the civil society side, sometimes it's more of the government side. I would say a critical missing piece over our history, and not just OTI, but aid in general, has been that economic piece, the shorter-term economic piece. Aid, since it was before we were even invented, going back to the Marshall Plan and others, we all understand that the economy is going to be the thing that makes this country succeed. But when you start getting into the more difficult environments, and those environments that are actually in a shorter time frame, we've sort of pushed that economic piece out because it's so hard. And I think I agree the last 10 years have seen a huge, huge improvement in that realm. But when you get to the nasty places, the places where bullets are still flying or they just stopped, we still have a long way to go to make those public-private partnerships happen. My agency, USAID, has gone a long way in that direction, but not in these environments. And I think it's great Chevron and others are delving into that. And I think we have to meet them at least halfway and look at that.
I have a little bit of a different question listening to you, all of your comments. And one thing we have not talked about much, and I think you all face it, look at it, we'll look at it from a little bit of a different perspective. What about good governance and corruption? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't deal with those issues, the economic development is problematic at best. The foundation of this is governance, transparency, and a lack of corruption. How do you approach that? And it's a question to all of you, whoever wants to venture forth first.
Well, we were talking about this earlier, I mean, trying to just deal with corruption or just build state institutions or just develop an economy, that's not going to be successful. It's that we're all coming together to collaborate because we're all going to work on different pieces. If we collaborate really well, we're going to work on different pieces together so that you've got to be developing economy while you're building state institutions, while you're trying to increase transparency, and you're going to make some mistakes, and there are going to be phases in the kind of cycle that don't look like you'd want them to look, that you're like, that's not quite a democracy, guys, or that's not really a free market, but you're going to have to be creative and not expect that you can do one thing after another. You're not going to have the perfect state institutions. You're not going to have the perfect regulatory framework before you go in. So we've got high-risk companies that can take higher risk that may come in the beginning of economic development, and they're coming in while the regulatory environment is not one that some publicly traded companies would come in for. But over time, maybe we can start to work on that and work on the state institutions.
Well, one of the things that we have found out is that we hardly can determine where hydrocarbon deposits would be found. Sometimes they are found in places where they're easy to get at and where they have a stable government, a government that despises corruption and is interested solely in promoting the good, but not always. And so John said, what used to happen is you go into a place and then you start finding out what you're getting into. That's a perfect recipe for disaster. And but that used to be the industry's model some 50, 60 years ago.
I think that was everybody's.
Yeah, you go after the hydrocarbons and then you deal with whatever problems you find. But we've learned quite a bit, and one of the things that you do now is there is no law that says you have to do a social or political risk assessment. But you understand that that's one of the key things that you need to do now before you start taking those investment decisions. And even when you realize that you're moving into a place where the situation is not quite what you'd expect it to be, you're going in there with your eyes wide open and with a plan as to how to address these issues. But you also understand that you can't solve every problem and that there are other people who are better suited to deal with different issues, but that you can work in a collaborative fashion with the non-governmental organizations, with government, and with other players to contribute what you're best positioned to contribute in ensuring that you create an enabling environment for business and also promote good governance.
I'd say one, words matter, and what you call an issue when you go on in there, you call it corruption. Mm-hmm. Is it really corruption? I mean, do you really know what you're talking about? Does it sound good because it reads well on the paper? We're fighting corruption. Okay, great. I've just looked and said I'm going to work with him over there, but you just called him corrupt, and now I'm going to go try to work with him. He's going, you're a butthead. Why don't I want to work with you? You just call him corrupt. You don't even understand what I'm doing. So you know, words matter. People's feelings matter. Mm-hmm. So how you label the problems you're dealing with and how you label the people you're dealing with. Let's be realistic here. Let's start to be a bit adultish about it. We go into rough places. We're going to deal with folks who have blood on their hands. We're going to deal with folks who've done bad things. And we're going to have to figure out a way to work with them, around them. But again, you know, to what degree? And that's the challenge. As Krista said, it's multifunctional. It's multidisciplinary. How do we bring in the multidisciplinary approach? One of the ways to go in is to embrace those watchdog elements. I mean, as a military guy, for me to say, hey, go embrace Human Rights Watch. Woo. Okay. but let's go do it. Go grab them. Sit down with them before you go in, because you know what? You're going to learn something. You're going to sit down, and they're going to tell you, here's what I think of you. Okay, great. That's not very flattering. Why is that? Okay, here's why. Okay, got it. So here's, and you might actually learn things that failed before you go in, and you go, wow, okay, got it. So embrace those watch groups. Walk on into this. But get them to also realize that they need to be talking about the effort you're making, but be critical of you when you make a mistake, and then be honest. You're going to want to make a mistake. You're going to screw up. It's going to happen. I mean, when you put 65,000 troops somewhere, they're going to do something wrong. Imagine that. Okay, so how do we deal with it? At least we've thought about it beforehand, and we're saying we want you to help us watch this so we minimize what we do wrong. Because I know I'm going to screw up. Just don't keep on screwing on up, and I can learn from it. That's the challenge. And it's got to be that, again, forcing you to think, well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And, well, no, I haven't. Okay. My plan can only get better by embracing the watchdog.
If I could just touch on that a bit, too, because it is that ability and acceptance to make some mistakes that allows you to get anything done in these environments. Yes. If you go in and you wait for the perfect plan, you won't get anything done. We like to say it's better to be 80% right at the right time than 100% right too late, because you can't figure it all out. And if you look at all these different environments, and they're so very different in many, many ways, corruption is one of those things, maybe the only thing that you find in almost every one of these places to some varying degree. And you're not going to, as you alluded, you can't fix that in a day. I would also say, though, one thing that every one of these countries shares are non-corrupt people, or at least people that don't want to be corrupt. It might be the system. They might have to be corrupt. Goes back to your define what this is. Are you corrupt, or you're just an entrepreneur? And if you want to get a phone sometime this decade, you might have had to pay a bribe. We have to be, I liked, adult about it. You have to know that some of this is going to happen. But then you also find those people that really, really, really want to change their environment. You find them, you work with them, you can use them as models. You use the media to make a bigger splash than you actually can get from that one or two or three activities that person's doing. You can find, of the 14, 15, some of these countries have, I don't know, 45 different ministries. There might be one or two ministries that might not even make the most sense to work with. But if you find that minister and her or his team feels the same way we do about these things, then you start working with them, and other people start to see, and we've seen this in a lot of different countries, don't ask me to name them, corruption is highly inefficient. Corruption is expensive. Yes. And there's a way to partner. Again, be adult. You're not going to change the world in a day, but you can find people and teach them or show them that if you do it in a non-corrupt, open, and transparent way, they actually can get more results and get the benefits of that, and for a cheaper price because they're not having to pay the tax that is corruption. But I would return to the point of, you got to know that this is going to take a long, long, long time, and you have to have some tolerance for risk and a tolerance for an imperfect world.
Yeah, I think one of the dilemmas here, just for a comment, is that, and I think it was in the World Bank study, that they pointed out that fragile states or some of these in unstable areas aren't just difficult development problems, they're different. Mm-hmm. And I think the tolerance for risk is a big element. And while everyone sitting here says we have to be able to tolerate that and deal with it, you have inspectors general and a Congress who says, oh, no, corruption is corruption. So there's an education process that has to go on, I think, as we work more in these states. They're another category of countries we're dealing with, and they have to be dealt with in a different way, and people have to understand that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of confusion about that sort of thing. If we can go back to Nigeria again. Deja, I think Chevron has a global memorandum of understanding that you guys have concluded and are working on in Nigeria. And could you talk a little bit about that, that initiative?
Yes, I certainly could. People say that if you want to know who I am, you've got to know where I've been. And that's the story of Chevron in Nigeria. In 2003, we had a really violent inter-ethnic conflict going on in the Niger Delta. It led to many deaths, whole villages were sacked. And overnight, Chevron turned into the International Red Cross. We took in over 2,000 displaced people from these communities in our Scrabble's facilities, and we had to charter planes to ferry them out of the Niger Delta because it was so bad. We then had to shut down 120,000 barrels of oil production a day and evacuated some of our facilities. It was a low point in our operations in the country, but was also an opportunity to innovate. We spent the next 18 months taking a good look at what we could do differently. And we then came up with this idea of the Global Memorandum of Understanding. It's a new approach to community engagement and stakeholder engagement. It's also a platform for communities to contribute effectively to their own development. We had spent the 1960s, 70s, and 80s doing things for the community, trying to step in where the government was absent. We realized that that was not the best model, not in the 80s, not in the 90s. We had to do things with the community, not for them. We had to work with other people, and so we developed this model that has five key elements to it. And the first one is what you call participatory partnership through multi-stakeholder engagement, which is what John talked about. You've got to know that there are other people in the play here. You've got to talk to the communities. You've got to talk to non-governmental organizations. You've got to talk to human rights organizations, environmental rights organizations, development agencies. Gone are those days when you're an oil company and all you need to do is to deal with the drilling. All you need to do is to deal with the production. Now we're dealing with the people issues, because if you don't deal with the people issues, then there's no oil to be produced. You can't have an enabling environment for business if you don't address those issues that cause conflict, that leads to insecurity. So the first one was participatory partnership through multi-stakeholder engagement. Building trust through transparency and accountability. We'd been in the country many years, but some of the people we were working with didn't even understand how the oil industry works. It was such a closed club. We have to open it up. We've got to let people understand what is possible and what is not possible. One thing that you said is this notion that the oil industry is all powerful. We can get government to do absolutely anything. It is a myth that you know, and it was time to get people to see that. Then we talk about sustainable development. In the early days of the oil industry, you talk about sustainable development. What's that? We've never heard anything like that. So we've had to learn that there are things that we didn't think was our business that was in fact the key to our survival. And so we decided the third element of this new model was to promote sustainable development through community ownership and by building the capacity of the community to deal with the issues. The fourth element was conflict management. What it meant is that we needed to understand what has the potential to develop into a conflict before it starts. We needed to be out there and understand the issues, the primary motivation of people, the high unemployment, the poverty, the corruption, the lack of infrastructure, the basic needs of the people that we didn't take into consideration in the past. That has to be part of this model. And finally, continuous monitoring and evaluation. We've got to continue to monitor the whole model to see where we need to, what we needed to do, and how we needed to deal with it. As I said, this is not an easy environment. You have issues related to culture. You had issues related to ethnicity. You had issues related to women. Women didn't have a voice in their community. You had issues related to youth. Youth didn't have employment. You know, so you've got to get your arms around all these things. And the GMO, you provided us with a platform to get these things out on the table. So we developed this model that has Chevron, that has the state government, that has non-governmental organizations, that has the community, and has donor organizations sitting around to deal with the issue. It wasn't something that we thought we could deal with. And we found common grounds. We found that each one of us has a stake in promoting peace and eradicating the conflict in that area.
Interesting. Krista, you're on the steering committee for the voluntary principles on security and human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And that, how do these voluntary principles relate to civil society organizations and other organizations that work on security issues with the private sector?
So I should just say, for those that don't know, the voluntary principles on security and human rights was created, I think now we're 12 years ago or so, and it came out of the need really for the companies to work with governments and NGOs to figure out how they're going to deal with the security issues that they were facing in conflict environments. And together as the three groups, we wrote up the principles, which basically lays out kind of that you do a proper risk assessment, understand the environment that you're operating in, have rules of engagement for the private security, well-vetted private security, and then working on the relationships with the public security. Now, the public security is the really, really important one, and really kind of the crux of why the voluntary principles was formed, is because the companies are not all powerful and cannot tell a government to fix their military or fix their police. We have to work together. And we talked a little bit here about language. It's also what you call it. John, I couldn't agree more. Because when you come in and you say, okay, we want to fix your human rights, you guys have a problem with your human rights with your security forces. Well, the security forces aren't going to listen to you. And they're going to kick you out pretty fast. But if you're talking to them about professionalization, rules of engagement, use of force, you can actually get a whole lot better faster. Because all we really want to do is protect civilians. But that's something the NGO community needed to learn from the government, or military has to teach that to other parts of government.
Mm-hmm.
The corporations, their security guys had to kind of teach it to us. We all had to kind of learn from each other. And, you know, we go in using the wrong language sometimes. The last thing you're going to do is take somebody, a troop member, and sit them down and tell them what year the UN Declaration of Human Rights was written and think that that's going to make a difference. I mean, we're talking about behavioral change. And behavioral change only comes when you actually respect the person that you're talking to, mm-hmm. and help them improve their behavior by helping, giving them the tools to improve their behavior, not by wagging a finger or, you know, giving them some lecture on human rights. So the Voluntary Principles has been one platform of many different initiatives where I think we've come together to kind of learn, okay, here's the challenge. Now, how are we going to do this? How do we work together? But also, what do we know about the different things that are going to take that we need to teach each other? So it takes a long time. But I really believe that the Voluntary Principles has made a difference. One of the things working on, what I work on, which is preventing conflict, is I'm successful because something doesn't happen. Yeah. How do I prove that to anybody? You know, the foundation world, and I'll just my last bit, the foundation world always wants, you know, evidence that the project has worked. And their board expects the numbers that are going to tell them, yeah, that investment was good and it fixed X, Y, and Z. And, you know, truth be told, it's the, you know, the dog that didn't bark. It's the, you know, mm-hmm. hey, there were 25 protests this year and no one died. You know, that doesn't quite sound right. The other issue with...
That sounds great.
Well, yeah, it actually is great. And I had a security manager actually say that about 5 mines in South Africa just recently, that of all the mines in South Africa, we've had many fatalities there in the last couple months. He's had 0 fatalities. And he says he attributes it 100% to the implementation of the Voluntary Principles, because they've been training on what they're going to do together when the protests occur, so that the people are treated with respect and the protest doesn't escalate into violence. So also on the long-term, short-term piece, mm-hmm. Again, with the foundation world, is every 2 or 3 years they decide, well, it hasn't been successful yet. The problem isn't solved, so we got to stop funding that. And they go somewhere else. So mm-hmm. you got Congress that does it, mm-hmm. and you have the foundation world that does it. One thing I found with the corporate world, particularly with extractives, they're there mm-hmm. for the long haul. And sustainable for them means something different. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why we find working with the private sector good, because the foundations are 2 to 3 years from now, they're going to be on something different. And that's not long enough to do what we need to do.
Good. Well, I'm going to ask one last question of everybody. And so start thinking about what you'd like to ask, because then we're going to open it up to your comments. And we'll take 3 questions at a time. And please be succinct, so we can get into as many questions as you want to. As we've had this discussion for the past few minutes, one thing that comes up continually, and you've all mentioned it in different ways, is that the various elements, the government, the civil society, military, the private sector, have to learn to work together and improve their coordination and that sort of thing. And it's much easier, as you said, in the field, and it's really hard to do in a place like Washington. How do we make that happen in a more effective way than has been done up till now?
I'll just
go for it.
It's not something that can't be fixed. It's something that takes it takes commitment and energy. We have 10 years of professionals going out and struggling in Iraq and Afghanistan. By God, if we can't learn from that, and we ought to all be shot. I mean, we had 10 years of failing, 10 years of making mistakes and then getting better. As one former ambassador mm-hmm. said, it seems to take us 5 years before we get on the right track. Mm-hmm. Because we walk on in the first 5 years, everyone's going to, you know, I have the best solution, I can't learn from anybody else, there's been no lessons learned across the organization, and they go in for 5 years and they screwed up royally, and then finally at the fifth year you start getting people coming in for their second and third tour, and they go, well, maybe I ought to talk to that other organization. Maybe I could learn from them. So we got to capture that back here, and really, what are the key things we need to focus in on? And I think there's some key mental models we need to focus in on. One is truly cultural awareness. I mean, I'm so sick of hearing about 16 cups of tea or 5 cups of tea. Or, geez almighty, Pashtun Wali. You know, they're really crazy. They get really upset when you go through their house and search women's things. Well, mm-hmm. shit, in Brooklyn, if you did that in my mom's house, I'd be pretty upset too. So, I don't know. You know, maybe that's Italianism. I don't know. But the point is, you know, and 16, 5 cups of tea, whatever, 3 cups of tea. Tell me who you can't sit down with on the first time you're going to be instant friends. Tell me who you don't have to sit down and go through multiple meetings to get to learn. So having an awareness of what culture really means. Understanding, most of us don't understand our own damn culture. And then we're going over there and we look at the Afghans and go, oh, their culture is terrible. Look at the things they do. Okay, why? Why are they at that level with their culture versus where we're at? One of the things we hear about, for example, rule of law. Oh, my God, traditional values versus formal system. And how come there's all these tribal rivalries going on? Okay, let's look at it. Literacy rate's about 20%. And there's this thing called situational ethics. We've been educated. We understand that situational ethics create challenges and problems. These folks who are implementing the rule of law as the traditional folks haven't been educated. They're using situational ethics, and they're pissing off the people when they do it. Imagine that. That's what we learned happens with situational ethics. So understanding those pieces, we have to get into our graduate schools. We have to get into our colleges. We have to get then into the professional development of our government employees, of our non-governmental workers, and we have to really get at understanding what we mean by cultural awareness and understanding those things. And those one and the other is assessment, the ability to go in and do a dynamic assessment of a situation. We seem to go into assessment, and then we go in and we don't realize that we as players are both being impacted by and impacting upon the environment, and we don't have the mechanisms in place, we don't even think about it, of assessing what's the impact we're having and what's the impact they're having on us. And those are two key mental models. And the culture, that if we just improve people's awareness to those two areas from an educational point of view, you would improve the ability to operate in the field as a more of a holistic fashion.
I couldn't agree with John more. We're in Washington, D.C. We put on suits and ties or the equivalent. We come to a think tank, and we talk about these things and think that we have to use $20 words and have these big theories. I think the book was what everything I ever learned in kindergarten is all I ever needed to know or whatever. It's not rocket science, but somehow we miss it a lot of the time, right? I think everyone's already touched on it, on listening to people and trust and respect and knowing where the other person's coming from. I am not the world's biggest fan of donor coordination conferences, right? There are... Not that you don't need them, that's good. I'm trying not to get fired today. But another meeting in Geneva helps usually most of the folks that go to all those meetings in Geneva. Or wait, oh, didn't I see you in Geneva last week? And then, oh wait, we're in New York this week. That's awesome. When we get, and you pick the topic, whether it's, oh, why did donor coordination work so well in this instance? Or, why did this PRT in Afghanistan work so well? Or why did this thing happen in the Niger Delta so well? If I had a dime for every report that came up with, it comes down to the individuals involved and the people. And people never like that. They want a structural, big $20 word think tank thing they can talk about and say, no, we figured it all out. It comes down to the people. It comes down to shut up. You talk too much. You got to listen more. It's you don't have all the answers. It's they are coming from a place that is just as real as the place that you're... I didn't know you were Pashtun. That's awesome, John. I've known you for a long time. Did not know that. And people don't like that. It's not a good enough answer for them, but it's actually that is the answer. When things work, it's because you get highly committed people in the same space decided that they're going to agree on the objective to some degree, and they make it work. And anything other than that can try to get us there and try to give those people the tools they need when they find themselves in that environment. But that's what it always comes down to. And I'll shut up just after this one thing, but we throw around the term sustainable development, which is a great term. It's the term at AID, always has been. I have no problem with the term sustainable. Everything we do, we want to be sustainable. And I got no problem with the term development, because we all are after development. My office, a few months ago, we just started a program in Honduras. And we had an assessment team in Honduras looking at what we needed to do to help the situation out there. If you haven't noticed, Honduras has a very big problem with violence. While our team was there, USAID Honduras, my organization, USAID, was celebrating our 50th anniversary of development assistance to Honduras. Now, I'm very proud that USAID has been around for 50 years. But there's a lot of countries in the world where we've been celebrating that we've been at this for 50 years. That is sustainable development. I'm not sure that's what we're talking about now. we're realizing that maybe we haven't been looking at all the aspects of the problem. And I think by jumping into and with the private sector on these things, jumping into the realm of we have to look at the root causes of the problem, that might be sustainable, and I hope it's development, but I hope it's not sustainable development.
I just wanted to chip in. I think what everyone has been talking about here is what I'd like to call the humble approach.
Yes.
I think that, you know, it's that attitude that takes you into a place where you know nothing about. It's the opposite of the humble approach. You assume that there's no problem you can't solve, that there is no adversity that you cannot meet. But the humble approach says you listen more, you learn more, and then you work more with other people, and then perhaps you'd find the right solutions. And I think that that's all I have learned, and I think that's all we are learning every day as we work our way through the issues in the Niger Delta.
Krista? Yeah, I had a meeting in Indonesia, and it was companies and NGOs. And they were both throwing around the word sustainable a lot. And in our meetings, we were having them talk. You know, we weren't trying to talk or bring something. We were getting information from them. And it is about listening, because all of a sudden I started recognizing they were both using the same word, sustainable. It's a great word. But it was meaning something very different. And so I asked, you know, the NGOs to describe what sustainable was. And I asked one of the company representatives to describe it. Lo and behold, for the company, sustainable was, hey, the problem actually gets solved. And for the NGO, it was, our program keeps to run forever and ever. Not the same thing at all.
Well, I don't know if I'm excited or depressed here, but now we'll switch and take your questions or comments. So we'll take three at a time, and then Sean?
Sean Carroll from Creative Associates International. Good to see my colleagues, formerly at AID, Bill and Rob. Thank you for this. My question, mostly for Mr. Hustrup, but anybody can jump in. How broad and deep do you think corporate spending on development can go? You know, there's sort of no doubt that any development work should consider public-private partnerships now, and we originally saw sort of, you know, people who made a lot of money in business, Soros, Gates, Buffett, Carlos Slim now, putting their money into development, and it's gotten very, very big. In some countries, there's more money from them than there is from traditional donors, from bilateral donors. How far and broad? People say corporations are going to start spending that kind of money on development. Others say, no, really only if their operations are threatened, they're being attacked, protests are stopping operations. What do you think?
Okay. We'll kind of work our way this way. Anybody else here? All right, we'll work our way. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Madison Iannone, Chemonix International. My question is actually for Mr. Hastrup, but also for Mr. Jenkins and Ms. Hendry. Chevron has obviously done a fantastic job in promoting and innovating within community engagement, particularly in the Niger Delta. But there are also a lot of companies that have not and seem to still not fully understand the way in which to work with NGOs and USAID particularly. What are some of the strategies that you have seen work productively from the corporate side and also from the NGO and USAID side to promote public-private partnerships, particularly for those organizations and companies that have not done well?
Do we have one more? We're there. Then over here.
I'm Andrea Yassine from DevEx Impact, which is itself a public-private partnership between USAID and DevEx.com. I think you've stated clearly why extractives are here to stay for the long run. Could any of you talk about other industries and sectors who have been involved in development work successfully in your experience?
Devshi, I think you might want to start with the first one on corporate spending.
Yes, the first thing I've got to say about that is that I'm one of those people who don't think that you throw money at development problems. I think that not every problem can be solved with funds. And sometimes you find that you're spending next to nothing and you're creating opportunities for people to actually grow their capacity to do things that they were never able to do before. So I really don't like to talk about the numbers, whether companies should spend more or less. What I think is important is to recognize that, yes, the private sector has a role to play in sustainable development, but it cannot replace government. I mean, it's just the same way that you can't take the role of government, the primary responsibility for security away from government and step in there. But you understand that working with other people, that you can actually contribute to undermining those elements, those issues that lead to conflict, that promote lack of development. So, you know, I don't know if I'm addressing your question, but I'm not sure that putting more money into it is what we really need. It's understanding the root causes of underdevelopment, of lack of development, and what needs to be done. When you listen to other people's stories, you'll understand that sometimes it's not a question of funds at all. Sometimes people just want to be respected, and they're angry because they're not getting the respect. Sometimes it has to do with their culture. Sometimes it has to do with corruption. And sometimes half of the funds that we pour into development don't actually get to do the development work that they're intended for. So, yes, we need as many more people to throw their hat in there, but I wouldn't like to talk about how much more money should be poured into development, but how better can we really do this development. The lesson that we have learned is to understand our limitations. I keep calling it the humble approach. You've got to recognize that, yes, I've got a stake in this and there's a role for me to play, but I can't solve all the problems. And it doesn't matter how much money I have or how much I want to throw into it, it might not result into a stable or sustainable situation. And then I think there was a question about what has worked in promoting public-private partnerships. Right. I think it's respect for expertise that each party brings to the table. When you look at the oil industry today, we are employing more people with experiences, skills, and competencies that used not to be recognized as being important in the industry. And that has to do with a recognition of what this kind of skills can contribute to the global business world as we see it evolving. And I think that when you understand that you need the other party, and you understand in order to understand that, you've got to learn a lot about the other party. And it's not just by visiting the site on the internet. You've got to interact with people. You've got to study how they behave. I mean, as she said, sometimes what people consider to be sustainable is not what you're thinking is sustainable. So you've got to understand each other. You've got to be clear about each other. Like any relationship, you've got to keep working at it. It requires commitment. It must be that you believe strongly in what they bring to the table. It's not just because you want to be seen to be working with a group. And that's those are some of the things that we have learned.
I would, I am neither a biologist nor an economist, but I do think most of us can agree that most of us work based upon our own self-interest, like it or not. For many, it's an enlightened self-interest. So your Gates Foundations and this great, in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen that these foundations that have large amounts of money that actually don't want to get anything out of it than trying to help the common good is fantastic. But not everyone is George Soros. Not everyone is Bill Gates. So when you look at strategies for pulling other companies in, so the extractive industries have to be there for a long time. It's in their self-interest to keep a country together. There are others that might not need, that's not what they're focused on, but they're focused at market share, they're focused on getting the message out. I was in Philadelphia last week, they were preparing for the Philadelphia Marathon. We've all seen, you know, this event sponsored by, and there's 14 or 15 different logos. You pick the event, you pick the logo. Why does a company do that? Well, they think that a marathon in this instance is a good thing. They also want to put their logo up. They also want to have their name associated with something. So you go to various countries, and there's lots of companies there, usually the ones that are in a growing market that need more people to buy their thing and a need to keep them buying it. So we found, you look around, telecom industry, in many of the countries that we're at, particularly cell phone companies, are the wave of the future. They're all looking for more people to use their product, and they're looking for more people to think about them instead of jumping off their plan and the other plan. But you can see both Coca-Cola and Pepsi in many, many countries have done a lot of good work in public partner. Why? Because everyone might want a Coke if they don't actually want one if they don't know a Coke exists. So those companies are looking at it from their own self-interests. I was part of an NGO for quite a while, and we partnered a lot with banks in Africa. Banks that were trying to get out to the small villages that development work took them to, that project gave them a vehicle to get out there and put their logo up. And this is being adult about it. The bank isn't just trying to save the world, right? It's great if they can help save the world as they're doing it, but they have a self-interest. So you look at who has a self-interest that matches up with this. And then how do you turn that into mutual interest? And there you go.
I was going to say something very similar, and this goes out to NGOs. You know, the demonstrative effect goes really, really far. And if as NGOs we'll praise a little for when the companies do good things, then we might find a lot more companies want to do them. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, to put a lot of effort in and to get no recognition, well, that's not very much of a demonstrative effect. The other thing I think NGOs need to understand is to get the business language a little bit, because when you're talking to companies that aren't publicly traded, mm-hmm. and maybe don't worry about brands, so we're talking state-owned now, if they can make more profit because doing this stuff actually makes your security costs lower, it makes the chance of a shut-in less, you know, if it actually is more profitable, then they'll do it too. And so we don't need to always be talking about things, it's the language you use, about it's the right thing to do. But no, it's good business. I was just at a state-owned Chinese mine in Laos, just came back from there, and I have to say it was best in class. And it's because they, you know, they bought an Australian company, and they said, you guys are running this fantastically. Just keep running it the way you are. And that is a demonstrative effect that I'm hoping will go through, because we keep saying at these meetings, you know, oh, but the state-owned Chinese, what are we going to do about them? You know, let's start, when we talk about it being good business, they're going to want to do it too. It is good business.
If money could solve the problem, then by God, we would have fixed Iraq and Afghanistan a long time ago. I mean, SERP, just think about it. God, we've done so much bad with, bad with SERP. But when you look at it, when applied effectively, and I'll shout out to OTI through their Afghan Stability Initiative program, one of their programs, and that's where I met a lot of the OTI folks that I know, is the application of SERP and development funds in a way that was done through the community, by the community, for the community, and they got to be a part of how that was applied. Mm-hmm. It goes back to Denji's point of didn't need a whole lot of money. We found out often what you needed is just to listen. What they wanted was representation. and money wasn't going to help get somebody from Kabul to come in and listen to what these folks wanted in the Agandab Valley in Sangin. That wasn't going to solve it. So again, money isn't the solution, but by God, we used it in the early days of Afghanistan as a policy default because we don't want to put the time and energy into solving the problem because we didn't do nation building. We've been there for how many years? Ooh, I don't know what the hell we've done, but it hasn't been built a nation. But we have wasted a lot of money. So it's a clear example. It's just not going to work unless you get in and really understand why they are resorting to violence and what it is you can do to help them stop resorting to violence. And most of the time we found out it wasn't money.
I would just add on that, I have never met a trite phrase I don't love. small is beautiful. Yeah. And a lot of these things, the larger the amount of money, the more you see local voices being pushed aside. The stakes get too high to slow down, or the stakes get too high for the other. And if you do things on a smaller scale, especially at the beginning, it's just that much easier to do it the right way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other questions? Here?
Thank you. For Leukemia Kimeji, MIPP, Johns Hopkins University. I think that you've all done a fantastic job. I think a lot of you have spoken about good governance, corruption, but I think one thing we haven't heard of is the politics. I think that the political economy of most transitional conflict and fragile states, it's very tricky. And so if you're coming from a military provision services point of view as an NGO and for an aid perspective, how difficult is that to have a sort of strategic plan in place, considering that most of this government are there for 2 years or less? You're looking at military coups, you're looking at governments, you're looking at, you know, factions and the like. So how difficult it is from the private sector perspective to actually have a strategic plan in place, and how do you go about it from all your different points of views? Thank you.
Other? Joanna? Well, go back there, and then Joanna.
Hi, I'm Bill Hess with the State Department. We work in the Office of U.S. Foreign Assistance Resources, and the director of my office was actually recently on a trip with some USAID folks, and she was wondering how they're doing with the adjustment of working with not only private sector companies that are looking for funds from USAID to do projects with you guys, but also folks like the Gates Foundation that don't need the money, and also organizations like Walmart that doesn't want money but wants USAID's assistance in knowing how to best make an impact in areas where, like you said, let's be grown-ups, they have self-interest, but where they aren't exactly sure how exactly to go about making the biggest impact for themselves but also for stability in countries like, I believe, Walmart's getting big in South Africa and other places. Thank you.
I'm Joanna Nesseth with CSIS, and what you're saying here is really not very earth-shattering or very exciting to rally around, right?
Sorry.
You're saying, let's have more dialogue, and we actually don't probably need a lot more money to have more impact. And so I wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit more about the type of dialogue you found to be effective when you bring people together and you start to share ideas. Do you use a common approach, or do you just start by saying, you know, sort of who are you and what are your interests? And then I wanted to ask a second quick question, probably of you, John, which is after 10 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, what we hear a lot on the development side is, you don't really look to those as a model because they're so unique, so unusual. But there have got to be some lessons coming out of it. And I wanted to ask if you have reference points as to some of the best lessons or resources for some of those good lessons that you guys have referred to a little bit here.
Okay, the first one, strategies and plans, particularly.
I think that was more.
Oh, you're the hot item here.
Going to make a trip worthwhile.
Well, you know, I'm not sure I got the question, but it seemed you were asking how do you make a strategic plan when governments are transitory? Government may be transitory. We know we're not going anywhere because we've got lots of investment. We're in there for the long haul. We've got to look at those things that would outlast different governments. You've got to have a long-term view. You can't tie your investments to a particular administration. So you've got to look at the long-term interest of the community as a whole, the people. I mean, there are people who are going to say, oh, this is a terrible government. Why don't you just get out of the place? Well, there are instances when the best thing to do is actually to stay in, because you would outlast that bad government and you'll be in a position to influence a better government for the benefit of everyone there. So your planning strategy has to be based on a long term, and your interventions have to be based on research. It has to be targeted. You have to understand very clearly what the future might hold. I mean, you can't totally predict what's going to happen. I mean, none of us knew of the Arab Spring before it occurred, but you know, you've got to have contingency plans. You've got to understand and be out of the box most of the time.
I was going to jump on that and say, strategies, you know, one, if we took everybody's definition of strategy, as many people as we have in this room would probably use definitions of strategy. I mean, that's one of the most poorly used words I've ever heard. But again, we all use it and talk about it. We really don't know what the hell it means, I don't think. But strategy, to get it simplified, strategy or strategic plan is about keeping policy options open. Tactical planning, or down at the local level, is about solving an issue right then and there. And at the operational level, we talk about that's knowing when to say, no, don't resolve that problem because I got to keep these policy options open. It will have a negative impact on the policy option, which is a long-term piece. Your tactical situation is a short-term piece, suffer through it. Or I have to resolve it right now because if I don't resolve it, it's going to disrupt the strategy. So again, you have to develop a plan that's looking out there and cannot be, as Dingy said, tied to any particular person or administration or condition, because if it is, it's going to fail, because that's going to change. The person's going to change, the administration's going to change, something's going to change. So again, what are the policy options you're trying to pursue? What are the long-term pieces you're trying to do? And then how do you make sure that you're working towards achieving those policy options? And then as you run into issues, what's the impact of those issues on the policy? So again, it gets at the ability of that dynamic assessment. How is that environment changing so you can understand, is that policy option still available? Or if you got to a point where you have to make a decision, you have to go right or left, you have to shut it down, or you've achieved what you were trying to do. So again, strategic planning cannot be tied to a government, to a person, to one condition. It will fail, guaranteed.
And I just add on the tactical level, so really when you've right. got to do something now, one of the things that we found very useful is to try to work with civil servants, non-elected, because they have less skin in the game for something to happen right away. They're there usually for the long term. So the non-elected government people are often really good to work with on the ground.
I'll add that, excuse me, not from USAID generally, but from my small office, OTI, our job is to work in the political space. So that's the challenge, not just that we confront, but that we actually were made to have to deal with, and it's difficult. I often envy my colleagues that work in the humanitarian realm, the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance and others. One, it gets at the monitoring and evaluation challenge you talk about, which is how many lives did you save? That's something you can actually measure. How many coups did you prevent? That's a little bit more difficult.
Yep.
They also have Mary Anderson's great phrase, do no harm. She didn't come up with it. I think the Greeks came up with it long, long ago. But do no harm. Do not do this if you can't be sure it's not going to hurt something. If you're dealing in the political realm, there's never that assurance. We wouldn't be able to do anything if there wasn't a risk to everything that right. we did. The important thing is knowing what that risk is and knowing if you're injecting any kind of assistance in these places, you are playing with the balance of power, which is what politics is, which is exactly why these places got to the bad place they're at. If it's a nice, green, lovely place that everything's wonderful, we wouldn't be there. So by definition, there's a thing at play here that's difficult. By definition, there's a balance of power we have to be conscious of. And by injecting resources into there, we have to be very, very careful, because that is going to upset whatever balance of power it is. We're there to change the balance of power.
Right. But it's transition conflict.
Exactly. So, and you have to know that you got to do it in little small bits, because you're going to get it wrong sometimes, and you don't want to make a big bet that's wrong on that one. Going back to Walmart and others, I actually had the surprising but great honor to be the head for a few weeks of the USAID OFDA Disaster Assistance Response Team to Katrina. Right? I never thought I'd be doing USAID work in Louisiana. Maybe. Working out of FEMA's headquarters at the time. You guys might remember there was some controversy over whether that was handled well. To my surprise, the organization that was really doing a phenomenal job in response to Katrina, both in Mississippi and Louisiana, was Walmart. Walmart used their extreme logistics capacity and know-how and the throughput they put into exactly where it needed to be was amazing. U.S. government had a lot to learn from Walmart in those situations. So pick the country. If Walmart now wants to help do what we're doing, and they want our assistance, why wouldn't we help? I think, and this bleeds into Johanna's question about positive and negative lessons, and there are a lot of lessons that are relevant in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's a lot of people that didn't want, some that still don't think, that humanitarian and or development realms should mix with military realms. In Afghanistan, then in Iraq, then back in Afghanistan, a lot of questions about that. If you take the philosophy out, and there's very valid concerns there and interests, if, and John mentioned SERP funding, if the military is going to be trying to do work that looks like in many ways and sometimes is identical to what us development professionals want to get done, if they're going to do it, why would we not want to work together very closely to help advise them? The military is always very open to advice, I've found. We have to be there to advise them. If Walmart is looking for advice, let's help them. And we're not going to solve these things with dollars. We're not going to solve them for free either. So if money is going to be spent and people want to come together and try to lower everyone's curve of learning by jump-starting it with, you don't have to learn that lesson. I learned that 10 years ago. Let's go for it. That's a good thing. There are a lot of lessons from Iraq and Afghanistan. Unfortunately, I think a lot of them validated what we thought we already knew, but now we just have bigger, more recent examples of, I look at Iraq. Listen, don't go in there with a plan, necessarily think that you can solve everything with money or with how many, I mean, we've all learned that over and over again. It's always nice to have a recent example to say, maybe not every problem can be solved by Americans that want to solve the problem. Maybe we need to slow down, listen, and not go for the perfect, and go for what's doable today.
I bet you have something to say.
I think you said it very well. I mean, the lessons learned, that they just, it's not rocket scientist. It really is. You know, the old expression, God gave you 2 years and one mouth, do twice as much listening as talking. It's, you know, but again, the need that we have to capture is that as the U.S. government, we need to work across boundaries better. Yep. As the U.S. government, we need to reach outside of government, because there's a lot of folks who have an idea of what's going on. And before we get into a conflict, if we focus energy, a foreign policy, on prevention, that if we do have to go into a conflict, we'll at least go into that conflict informed, because we took the time to try to prevent the conflict. And the military and every other aspect of the government has a role in prevention, in developing those developing the institutional capacity of countries that are close to failing. And if we take the time and work together at the country team level, which we are terrible at, let's not kid ourselves, we really are terrible at that. But if we were to improve working at the country team level, that when a conflict finally does erupt, you have a core group of folks who have an awareness of what's happening at that country team level and at that national level and the local level, and can help us inform our policy to go in and then stabilize and then look at transforming. And we've just not done a very good job of that. But it's the whole gamut. We have to be able to try to prevent that fails, we have to stop, And once that happens, we do have to go in and help transform. Otherwise, we're going to be back in it like Haiti six times. And how many times has it been in Haiti in the last 20 years? My God. I think we'd get it right yet. We haven't. But that, I think, is a key lesson.
Kristen?
Yeah, and getting those lessons learned, though, from both the past or from the different sectors gets to the dialogue and kind of the what we need to have real types of dialogues. And I just wrote down a couple ideas of things that I think are the only way that we're going to have dialogue. It's one, when we're allowed to come together as individuals instead of necessarily representing the organizations that we're with, because that carries a lot of weight behind it and a lot of responsibility, but we can talk as individuals. Sometimes we need to start with easier topics until we get to know each other a little bit. Don't look for consensus, look for understanding. I think too many models of having dialogue are driven with, you know, to get to consensus, and I think we need to just allow ourselves to disagree. Okay. And then also have a clear expectation when you're sitting down to dialogue that you know, what's going to come out of this. It might just be more dialogue. It's not that you're necessarily going to create an initiative, and my God, there's enough initiatives out there. I hope more dialogue doesn't necessarily lead to them. But I think just some ground rules, actually, for the dialogue, because we are still in different places, still learning how to talk to each other. I mean, we did pretty good together, but...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
But we had, a great moderator.
Why, of course. Any final comments?
Let me just jump in there. The truth of the matter is that partnerships are not the easiest things to make happen.
Are you married?
And that's another topic. But you know, we have a saying in Africa, and if you want to go fast, go alone. Mm-hmm. If you want to go far, go with others. Mm-hmm. And that's a lesson that we have learned and we take to heart. Partnerships are not easy, but if what you intend to do is to be sustainable, if you're in for the long haul, it's the space you have to play in.
I can't beat that. That's good.
Okay, well, this has been a very interesting discussion, and it seems to me, for me, I've taken away a few things that communication is really important, and a dose of humility is very helpful. And it sounds like working in unstable environments is a team sport. And everybody's got to work together. So please join me in thanking them. You turn that sucker off.